Their partner in community so far as the military is concerned, well, just as far as your, well, I think it might be better to, if I may, to go back to the time that I came to Victoria, the time that I decided to live in Victoria, and earn my living here. I was a complete stranger. I had never been to Victoria. I knew nobody in Victoria except for my wife. And so I started looking for a job. In addition, I had no civilian clothes, because all of my city clothes were back in Ottawa or Toronto or someplace. And I didn't have much sense of values either. I had always had the best of clothes for the war, that is when I was working in. Mm-hmm. It always had to be made to measure. And so I thought nothing of going down to a Chinese tailor and getting outfitted with suits that looked very good. But in the meantime, they had to wait while I was looking for a job. So I was going around in the kilt looking for work. And everybody I went to was extremely cordial and pleasant, but they all had the same remark. Our own boys are coming back, and we owe it to them to offer them the jobs they used to have. Mm-hmm. And I accepted that. I complimented them. But they wouldn't let me go without saying, you know, there's a chance that Joe might be able to help you. And they give me Joe's name and address. So I go and see Joe. Think to myself, that's nice of that fellow. Joe would have the same answer. And I tried hard, and I tried all kinds of things, but I got nowhere. And then I thought to myself, there has to be somebody in this town who'll tell you the truth. Somebody who hasn't any axe to grind, who doesn't care about me, but who knows how things stick around here. And I thought, newspaper editor, that's the sort of a fellow. At that time, the columnist editor's name was Sandon Graves. And a lot of old timers, I'm sure, remember Sandon Graves with a great deal of respect. Anyway, I had never met him, but I asked for an appointment, and he asked me to come and see him in such an hour, which I did. And he said, I think the best thing you can do is to think of some outfit which, whether it wants to or not, must expand. Mm-hmm. Because if it must expand, it's no use them telling you they have to hold jobs for the boys that used to work there. They've got to make room for new jobs. And he said, I think you should think of the utility field. BC Telephone is way behind in its services to the public here. BC Electric is in the far worst position because there's going to be tremendous growth and a tremendous demand for electrical service. Why don't you try BC Electric? Well, only two or three days before that, we had been interviewed by a man from BC Electric who was going around seeing what people thought of the company. And he said there are dozens like him doing the same sort of work. And this fellow was the most mamby-pamby, sissified son of a sea cook that one could ever care to mention. And I thought, if this is the kind of man that BC Electric would select, I don't want any part of it. But then I thought that this editor knew what he was talking about, so I went to BC Electric, and I saw a little bulldog-looking cockney assessing applicants as they came along, and he looked me over and he asked me a lot of questions, and he said, I think you're just the man we want. It's 175 months. Not bad in those days, you know. And Then he said, he looked at Joe and everything, but he said, you can't go around in that theme, referring to the kilt. Nothing could enrage a clown more than to have a kilt called a theme, unless you called it a skirt. So I jumped up, and I don't know what I looked like, but he jumped up too, said, oh, I'm so sorry, that's a kilt, isn't it? Well, would it be possible for you to wait until you had civilian clothes before you started work with us? So I said, oh, sure. So I started out with them, and they had some 300 men going around knocking on doors. We each had a list with, of questions asking, what do you think of so-and-so, and customer, was given full right and encouragement to speak exactly as he thought, because BC Electric had recently been reorganized at the top, and they knew that the public had not been consulted or cared about for years, and it was about time that they were given some consideration, some opportunity to express their feelings. So we got quite a lot of nasty answers, and it was very obvious that nobody loved the BC Electric. But the whole job only took about 3 months. And at the end of that period, the job being completed, the material being supplied to the company, it was time to kiss the men goodbye. And I was one of five men who was retained by the BC Electric for permanent employment. And they put me into the sales department. No, first of all, they put me in the temporarily in the transportation department, but they had a place they were getting ready in the sales department, and they put me there, and I stayed in the sales department for the rest of my career, which was very nearly 30 years, during which, of course, the BC Electric was amalgamated with BC Hydro. This was my civilian career, excuse me, and I don't know what I could tell you to make it of interest. To me it was interesting because every day I met somebody new, somebody different. My job was in the field, not behind a desk. I went out to people's homes and businesses and industries to give them all the help that I could, so that they could utilize the services of the company in their interests at the cheapest possible rates and so on. So I met a great many people that way and made a great many permanent friends too. Because I have always been throughout my life a people man rather than a thing man. Whereas my son can listen to the ticking of a motor and stop it and tear a car apart and put it together again with a great deal of delight, I shudder at the thought of poking my hands around. I would probably leave the motor on and shove my fingers through the fan belt or something like that. But people is a different thing. I would blame myself if I encountered any person who was totally disinteresting. I have many weaknesses, but at least I try to feel superior to others and to have compassion for those who have less than I. But this is developing Mark into a sort of the sake of analytical true confession session, I don't know, I want to oblige you by giving you whatever you need to have. But I don't want to embarrass you or myself by spilling beans which are overcooked.
Well, maybe we should head back a little bit towards the military bit to wind things up, and I think we've touched on it before, but in case you haven't, if you've got any more comments to make about your how you feel about your career with the Army during the war.
I'm grateful that it happened because it taught me so many lessons. The greatest lesson it taught me, I think, was the respect for my fellow human being. But there is an element of brutishness, not brutality, but brutishness, to Army life at its worst, which can lead a man backwards into the realm of the beast. And this, I'm smeared with this, I'm touched by it. I fear that I have at times reverted to it to some small degree, and I've lived with the shame of it ever since. And I don't see how this could be avoided by anybody who enters into military life and stays at it long enough to encounter it in all of its vagaries. The peaceful rigidity of barrack discipline and training. The carnage of the sudden onset in combat, the soft overtones of a leave among the delicacies which one would never have had even on Simi Street sometimes. All of these contrasting factors come into it. I think that for a man to say that he would like to be a soldier, or he was glad that he was a soldier, if he's honest, he must have wanted to live a different kind of life, a life which isn't natural at all. Because the aim and object of a soldier's life actually is to kill or be killed in the last analysis. And today, of course, we do it by remote control. I often wonder what kind of a soldier I would have been in the time of Caesar or Alexander, or even a little farther on than that. Agent Corps, if you like. But especially in those days when, during some of the biggest battles of history, the battlefield was littered with scores of thousands of corpses. And all of those men had been killed in the space of anywhere from 12 to 36 hours. And you begin to think of the pragmatic side of that battle, in that, at that period, the only projectile available to the soldier was the javelin or the dart or the sling or the arrow. And not everybody was armed with them. The common soldier was armed with a buckler and a sword, or a short one might have a dagger, which means that most of those scores of bodies lying in the field were hacked to pieces, hewn to pieces, hand to hand. And I think to myself, what kind of men would, what kind of a man would I have to be to fight in that manner? What kind of men were they? Yet they were men that could read and write, and I'm speaking now of the educated ones among them. They could love a wench, they could dance, they could farm, they had skills, a lot of them, they had feelings, they had tremendous loyalty to leaders whom they loved. It was part of life for them. And I'm not talking of mercenaries necessarily either. So, to me, an element of this ancient savagery, which is called warfare, must enter into the warfare of today. And I don't see how any contemporary soldier can avoid being tainted to some degree by some vestige of this savagery, if not a pretty heavy daubing of it. Nor do I see how he can divest himself of the scars and the taints that that savagery has brought to him. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be physical, it can be mental too. You can surrender as a soldier some moral codes, some ethical beliefs, which were deeply embedded in your psyche. You can surrender them in seconds sometimes as a soldier. And it's not always in order to survive. It is in order to gain some sort of a personal advantage sometimes. Any soldier who would open up his whole life and tell you the whole story of everything he did and everything he thought, I doubt whether very many of them would wish to be soldiers all their lives, and I doubt still more whether the hearer would wish to be like them. And yet they are not bad men. They are good men, most of them. They are doing what had to be done at the time. But I think I am glad that I had the experience, if anything, because of the worst elements in it. I can afford to be sorry for some people because they have not experienced these things. Therefore, they cannot have the same judgment about them. By the same token, I can, thank God I seldom do, but I can see a drunken soldier away from his quarters, away from his home, if it's a militia man, and I don't need to hesitate to ask him whether I can help him. Whereas, if I hadn't been in the army, I would probably pass him with loathing and perhaps go to the nearest telephone in order to get him picked up by the police. This is moralizing to a morbid extent, I'm afraid. But you ask a question which cannot be answered very crisply, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. One way of putting it is this, in my mind, and I will begin by saying that I have always been an opponent of the Korean, of the Vietnam affair, while it was on and since. But please help yourself here. Yeah. It is well known that the after effects of that war on some of its participants were horrifying, and they will endure forever for as long as the individual lives. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, however gruesome that war was, and however heroic the average GI was, I find it difficult to believe that all of the hellery that they went through was any worse on the whole than what a lot of our men went through in the last war, and their men went through in the last war. And yet, our men and their veterans of the first war don't go screaming up and down the country demanding special privileges or special consideration. They haven't collapsed into the dregs of society. They haven't succumbed en masse to drugs, as far as I know. And why is it that 1945 being over and the Korean War being over, the Vietnam War comes along, and that element of brutishness that I spoke of so strongly invades the participants? Why did it not hit all of us earlier? Mm-hmm. Is this a sociological problem? Probably you're an educated man, and probably you have better answers to this than I have. But it puzzles me quite often. It makes me wonder what sort of brutes will be engaged in the next major war. Mm-hmm. I think a man like you, for example, if they were either voluntary or enforced induction into the armed services, and you were involved, and you had to become one of those people fighting that kind of a war, I shudder to think at the transformation that would take place in you. Today, as far as I should see and look at you, you are the sort of man you should be, and maybe a lot more. How you could remain such a man after being a few months in the next war, if you can survive that long, I don't know. And that is one of the things we all have to face, especially when we think of your generation, when we think of our children and our grandchildren. Thank God, they don't seem to have as grim an attitude towards that contingency as some of us older people do. The fashion to suspect and deride and fear the Russians has been for years, and there's a great deal of ground for that. But I look back to some things that I've seen on TV, and one of them comes back to mind very vividly, and I don't know whether you saw it or not. It was an interview with Brezhnev and his little granddaughter, and he was talking about war and its consequences. Did you happen to see that?
No, I remember, I've never seen a picture of it, though.
Yes. Well, to me, the man's sincerity, the man's tenderness, the man's courage, the man's experience shone out. It wasn't some sort of a clown, some robust, ignorant hero. It was a man with a deep, caring sense for humanity at large. And I thought to myself, surely when there is an opportunity to negotiate with such a man, we shouldn't insist on our terms before we even negotiate. And then going on from there, I think of the SALT II and the nuclear arms race and all the rest of the discussion with Russia and the interminable gatherings that take the United States, excuse me, and Russia have had. And interminable sessions that the United States and the Soviet Union have had on these subjects seem to be stalemated time and time again. And we talked about the intransigence of the Russians, but I think in recent times there have been several occasions when the Soviet Union has said, we will do so-and-so if you will do so-and-so. If you will consider so-and-so, we will consider so-and-so. It starts with this. But the United States says that is a ploy to put us off our guard. It's a lot of nonsense, so we won't have any of it. Now, thank you. Traditionally, the boys in the State Department know about everything. But if this attitude of theirs persists, there's no point in Russia ever wavering one inch in the direction of the United States. Mm-hmm. If the suspicion occurs, certainly it seems to the United States is every bit as suspicious as the Soviet Union is. Mm-hmm. So where does that leave us? Leaves us with more stockpiling and more chimneying around. This is the sort of the world that you are going to live with and possibly have an effect upon, and it's the sort of the world that I will leave with a great deal of regret, if only because it's still so very interesting and hasn't been finished.
Mm-hmm. Well, my last comment or question would be if you have any topic or anything you want to discuss about your career that might be of any interest or importance. What was the highlight of your military career?
Well, the highlight of my military career, I told you at the beginning that I had no military training prior to the war, prior to my enlistment, and I felt that to a certain extent I was behind the eight ball, because I was probably 10 or 12 years older than the typical recruit. Mm-hmm.
And therefore, they might be stronger and brighter than I was. I've already told you that I had my idols that I saw in parade. I told myself, perhaps this is conceit, but I told myself the only way to get ahead in this man's army is to be noticed, and not for falling head over heels in the gutter some Saturday night, but for being the smartest man on parade, or the best turned out soldier in the platoon, or you name it. So I worked very hard, shall we say, to be noticed. And I was noticed, and I was promoted in the lower echelons quite rapidly. I think I told you I became a sergeant in about 5 months. When we were going overseas, when we were going to go overseas, I should say, the regimental colors, which had been stored in the officers' mess in Cartier Square, were to be deposited in the regimental church, which was St. Giles Presbyterian Church. This is always a very solemn ceremony with any regiment, and only picked men of all ranks are chosen to carry the colors and to guard the colors and to march the colors into the cathedral. And it happened that I was chosen to be a member of the color party. The color party was composed of an officer and four sergeants, I guess. I'm not quite clear about this. The colors themselves were carried by a sergeant major and